We continue in our series entitled Journey Through the Bible. We come this morning to a journey through Ruth. And this is, at least as far as the task set before me, in covering an entire book in 1 hour. This is the easiest so far, having covered Genesis, Exodus, and all the way through, with all of the characters, with all of the stories, with all of the information that's there. My task this morning is only to cover 4 chapters and a chapter of basically a single story. So I feel in some way great relief, but then I also want to make sure that I do it in such a way that is helpful. So what we've been doing in considering one book of the Bible each week is considering, first of all, a literary overview, some of the things that might help us as we come to read that particular book, its kind of a form or genre of literature, the purpose of the book, some of the literary introduction. Then we'll look at the outline of the book. And probably more than any of the other books we've looked at so far, we'll look more at the storyline and be able to dig in a little bit more. And then we'll come to see some themes and applications from the book. First of all, by way of literary overview, the book of Ruth, the title itself comes from the main character, Ruth, who is introduced to us as one of the wives of a particular family that we'll look at. But she emerges as the main character. Really, most of, or at least about half of the first chapter is setting up the backdrop for her to appear into the story. And then most of the story is mostly about her, God's provision for her, and the blessing of Naomi through Ruth. But really, she is the main character. And so from ancient times, this book has been titled for her. This is one of only 2 books in the Bible named for a woman. Of course, we remember the book of Esther that we'll come to in several weeks as well. In regards to the author, there are no ancient or very few ancient traditions as far as any definitive description of who the author is. It's really unknown. Possibly written during the time of David. Some say it's really Naomi that has written the bulk of the story. But what we have is at least that put into question, because at the end we have the birth and the announcement of this genealogy coming to David, and Naomi would not have lived that long. So it may be that she, through oral tradition or written tradition, passed that story along, because we have a particularly feminine woman's perspective throughout the book. So it may be some of her own oral or written tradition that's passed down. And then probably somebody during the time of David is the author, because it ends there. It doesn't go on to Solomon or anybody else in the kingdom. So as far as we can tell, it's probably written somewhere around the time of David taking the throne as the king of Israel. And so it's at least in part set to establish the genealogy of David himself. As I've already mentioned, it is written particularly from a woman's perspective. There are many things highlighted that would be seen to be particularly from a woman's perspective, in some of the emphasis on the grief that's found there, some of the pastoral and rural setting, some of the interaction that goes on. It's certainly not from Boaz's perspective or any of the men, but seems to be at least from Naomi or Ruth's perspective in that way. Leland Ryken says, not only is a woman the protagonist, the main character of the story, but the world of the story is, in major ways, a woman's world. And the writer gives attention to feminine values and feelings. And that's what one of the reasons I think makes it such a great story in the way that it's written. Regarding its purpose, it is to give a glimmer of hope and anticipation in the dark days of the judges. We came through the yucky stuff of last week, coming through the book of Judges, and I don't know about you, but coming out of that, there was just this sense of, ugh, I feel like I've been walking through a cesspool and sorting through some of these problems, and particularly as you get to the last several chapters in Judges, and it zooms in and talks about these personal sins and offenses. What would be nice is if we considered Ruth as another appendix at the end of Judges, which in some ways I think is why it is placed where it is. You have this yuck, yuck, yuck of these personal interactions. They're taking wives. They're doing all these things. You have the killing of the concubine. And then Ruth gives us a glimmer of hope that in the day of the judges, everything is not desperate. Everything is not despairing. That here is a glimmering light of hope in the midst of a particular family within Israel, and that God has not completely abandoned his people, and even uses some very unusual characters in order to bring about his purposes. So I think the main purpose is to give a glimmer of hope and anticipation in the dark days of the judges. Regarding the plot line, in the darkness and decline of the kingdom that we saw last week in the book of Judges, the decline of the kingdom of Israel overall, and even in the backdrop of personal tragedy, we see that the plot is that God works in His providential care to continue His purposes and display His character in a story of love, sacrifice, and marital blessing. It is also a hopeful bridge between Judges and the anticipated reign of King David. So it starts us in the days of the Judges, as you'll notice in chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the Judges ruled, and then the way that it kind of ends, if you go over to chapter 4 and verse 22, Jesse begot David. And so if you know Israel's history, it's like, oh, David is the king. David's this man after God's own heart. So it begins with this kind of dark, despairing backdrop. But by the end, it gives us a sense of anticipation. And the trajectory of it is such that it gives us hope and says, okay, all of this was done. And what is going to come out of this is David. And the people of Israel reading this would go, ah, oh, okay. And they would end with hope rather than despair. I think it's a better way to end this period of the Judges. Remember last week, it did end in despair. In Judges 21:25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And it's like, you've got this cycle of deliverances over and over and over again. And then you come into 1 and 2 Samuel after Ruth. But Ruth comes in and says, all is not despairing. Here's what God is continuing to do among a particular group of people. And He's setting the stage for the great King David, who, though not perfect, will be one who brings great hope to Israel and ultimately as a type of the great son of David, Jesus Christ. So that's something of the plot line. The main characters, of course, are Ruth, her mother-in-law, Naomi, that we'll be introduced to, Boaz, who becomes eventually her husband. There are some minor characters. Orpah is a great contrast to Ruth and her character and her commitment. And then we also have this unnamed rival that puts a bit of tension. Just when you think everything is going well and Ruth is going to get the man and there's going to be this great outcome and blessing, there's not a purposeful antagonist. He's not trying to cause trouble, but there's a nearer of kin that's going to come in and bring in a bit of tension to the story that if you were reading it for the first time, you would be thinking, what's going to be the outcome of this? And so those are some of the major and minor characters. Regarding the form or genre of the story, the people that I read, the scholars, some of the books that I read, almost all of them first and foremost classify this as a love story. First and foremost, a love story. There are familiar elements in that there's a rival in the love story with this nearer of kin. Is he the one that's going to get the girl, or is Boaz going to get the girl? So there is a bit of a rivalry here. There's a matchmaker in Naomi. She starts setting things up, and you can think of Fiddler on the Roof, you know, matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. And so she starts seeing what's going on, and she's anticipating some things, and so she's planning. She says, all right, go and do this to him and win his heart in this way. So there's a matchmaker. There's the account of the first meeting, a very moving account when he notices her and he says, hey, who's that girl? So there's a report of the first meeting. There's a report of the actual proposal and the courtship period. There's also a secret rendezvous at night when it's dark and you can't see people's faces. And when he realizes there's a woman at his feet, he's like, who is that? And he doesn't even know who it is. And she says, it's me. And so there's something of a secret rendezvous, and he tries to send her off before anybody else wakes up. So these have many of the familiar elements of a love story. It's also a redemption story, that the bigger picture is here is a woman who is without a people of God and without God, and in the end, through this human instrument, is redeemed and brought into the congregation of God's people. It's also a pastoral story in that it highlights a lot of agrarian and kind of idyllic country setting. It certainly exalts that. There's this connection with nature and with God as the sovereign over nature and the harvest that comes and goes. We see the importance of things like rain and giving of grain. So bread and sheaves and all of this field and agrarian language is used throughout it, kind of this pastoral setting. It's covering somewhere, and we're unclear because we're not given a lot of chronological cues throughout it, but it's probably covering, according to John MacArthur, somewhere between 11 and 12 years, that they may have been in Moab for about a decade, and then with the courtship and with the birth of the baby at the end, probably somewhere around 11 to 12 years. Now, there's a couple of main challenges, I think, as we read through the book of Ruth. First of all, it's the challenge to remember that this comes in the dark backdrop of the days of the judges. If we read it in isolation, it just sounds like a great love story, a very interesting story. But we remember that there's a purpose in this, in that it is during the days of the judges. When we read last week all of this horrible stuff that's going on, I think it's a challenge to make sure that we see just how bright this light is in the midst of the darkness. If you just kind of read it in isolation, the brightness of it and the hope that it's supposed to generate doesn't seem perhaps as bright as if we put it in the darkness of the book of Judges. The second challenge is to not run through a familiar story too quickly. And I found myself doing that. It's like, okay, here's the book of Ruth. I know the basic plot line. But forcing myself to read it over several times this week, try to enter into the story, try to really pay attention to some of the details, and to imaginatively enter into the narrative. Leland Ryken again writes, in terms of storytelling technique, verse for verse, the book of Ruth is perhaps the greatest masterpiece of narrative art in the Bible. And this is coming from, I think he's a literature professor up at Wheaton College, or at least was at one time, and has been exposed to a lot of literature. And for him to make that kind of a statement, perhaps the greatest masterpiece of narrative art in the Bible, I think we ought to pay attention to that with a man with a bit of authority and expertise in that area. So that's something by way of literary overview. And I hope even that encourages you, if you haven't been doing that this week, to get into the book of Ruth and read it. Well, let's consider something of the basic story, and we'll dig in a little bit more this week than we normally have been because of the brevity of the book itself. First of all, Unit 1 is what I'm calling Dark Days Become Darker. As I've already mentioned, in chapter 1, verse 1, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. So on top of all of the stuff, the book of Judges, put that in the backdrop, and then put in the middle of all of that stuff the fact that there's a famine. And when you think of famine, because most of us have not experienced famine, it's easy to just read that, look over and say, okay, people are hungry. But think about the consequences of famine. Think about the death of people. Think about the agonizing experience of watching relatives die from hunger, children's tummies swelling. Try to enter into it, and basically it's painting a picture of even greater darkness, that the reason that they go to another land out of Judah, which remember, they have come into the promised land, the people have been told by the Lord, this is your land, this is your inheritance, and for a Jew to voluntarily leave that land, things have to be pretty bad. And that's really what that little phrase, there was a famine in the land, is meant to do, is to convince us that things were so horribly bad that a man said, despite what I know of God's promises, I'm under a desperate situation that I'm going to die, my family's going to die if I don't move somewhere else. That gives us some indication of just how dark it's become. And then over the several other verses that follow, you've got the backdrop of Judges. It's awful. You've got the backdrop of the famine, which is awful. Now you bring them into this new land, and her husband dies. It gets darker. And then her two sons die. And it just keeps plummeting darker and darker and darker within these first few verses. Well, what about the characters here? Well, first of all, we're introduced in verse 1. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And so they've already got two sons. We're not sure exactly what age they are. Marriageable age at this point would be probably mid to late teenage years at the very latest, early teenage years possibly. And so somewhere around that period, if they go and then they marry there. So they're in the land of Bethlehem, or in the area of Bethlehem and Judah. They dwell and went to go and dwell in the country of Moab. And if you look at the layout of the land of Israel. You have here the Mediterranean Sea, the Sea of Galilee, the River Jordan. And so you have Bethlehem up here, and Moab would be down in the southeastern part over across the Jordan River. And so they're moving out of Israel's promised territory into Moab. It's important to understand that Moab and the Moabites are descendants from Lot and his oldest daughter's offspring. The incestuous relationship that took place between Lot after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and his oldest daughter created an offspring. And from that offspring, then you have the land of Moab. At this point, they are then considered Gentiles. They are worshipers of such false god as Chemosh and other deities. This is an idolatrous people. So for them to voluntarily move from here into the land of Moab, things must be really, really bad for them. Now we're told his name, first of all, the name of the man, verse 2, is Elimelech, which literally translated is, "My God is King." And then his wife's name is Naomi, that we're introduced here, and her name means pleasant. And we're going to see that that's a bit of narrative and providential orchestration, because she's going to go from pleasant to bitter. And you can look at this context, and when she says, "I went out full, but I have come back empty," you want to ask her the question, when were you ever full? And she means in her by relation to her family, but she's known dark days for a very long time. But her name indicates pleasant. Their two sons, their son's oldest son's name is Mahlon, which means sickly, and Chilion, which means pining or failing. I mean, how would you like to give your child knowingly a name which means weak or sickly? You know, and you wonder, did they look at him and you say, "Oh, this guy, I don't think he's going to make it, so I'll name him Sickly," or something like that. So even their names are somewhat prophetic because of what's going to happen to them. So there is this desperation in the midst of this famine, causing them to move some 50 miles for probably about a decade east of the Dead Sea to the land of the descendants of Lot. Then we're told, verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Okay, so we can easily read that, but let's think about it. Let's think, there's Naomi. She has moved her husband, the main breadwinner, the head of the household. They go into this foreign land. He courageously takes them there, and he dies. And what desperation a widow would have at that point at the loss of her husband. Well, at this point, if we follow through chronologically, after the death of the father, verse 4, now they took wives of the women of Moab. So now, to make things and bring about a point of tension, they have married Gentiles from another land. Okay? Remember, they were told, you need to marry basically within your tribes or within Israel. Now they're in a foreign land, and they've taken pagan, idolatrous women as their wives. This gives us some idea of just how bad things were in those days. Verse 4, they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other is Ruth, who becomes the main protagonist within the story. And he dwelt there about, well, there's the chronological key, about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the women survived her two sons and her husband. So they come, her husband dies, great desperation at that point. Take on two wives, the sons take on these wives, and now the men died. Things are just plummeting into desperation and darkness. And we shouldn't just read that and read over it. But at this point, here are two women in a pagan land. They're Jewesses. They were female Jews in this foreign land. They've got nobody to provide for them now. And they didn't have any women's widows fund at that time in Moab. You know, there was no government program that they could go to and say, "Excuse me, we're all widows. Could you please help us out?" They were responsible. And widows within those cultures were considered really as cursed by the gods. And so they would be asking questions, "Well, what did you do to lose your husbands? You know, there must be something God has cursed you, or the gods have cursed you." So it is painting a very, very bleak and desperate picture at this point. Then we come to verse 6. She decides to relocate. And apparently from what we see later on in the chapter, the famine, well, not later on the chapter here in this verse, that the Lord lifts the famine and the desperation of the famine after this time. And let me mention at this point that what you see throughout the book is God's sovereign hand over nature itself, the giving of bread, the giving of harvest. It was this book that was read by the Jews and may still be during the harvest, the celebration of the first fruits of the harvest, because of this agrarian language and the taking of harvest and of wheat and that kind of thing, of grains. So verse 6, she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. And that's going to be a common theme. When bread comes, it's because the Lord has given it. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So it seems like they've packed up. They're on their way. In verse 8, we have this very moving final scene between Naomi and Orpah and Ruth. Verse 8, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you." And that's a Hebrew word that means God's faithful covenant chesed, his covenant love with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So here she is, a Jew in a foreign land with Moabite daughters-in-law coming from an idolatrous, and she prays Jehovah, the God of Israel's blessing on them. And she said, as you've been kind to me, so they didn't say, well, our husbands are dead, and Naomi, now you're just on your own. They continued to show kindness and to care for her, and even Orpah did. Orpah didn't jump ship, and I think we ought to give her credit at this point for that, that she continues to show kindness and seem to have been a good wife to one of her of Naomi's sons. Verse 9, she continues this blessing, "The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." Let me pause just to say that the book of Ruth has a very, very high view of marriage. And this is one of the indicators. She has lost her husband. She has lost her sons. And this is very unsettling for a woman. And what she prays, verse 9, "The Lord grant that you might find rest." She considers marriage and the home a place that, when blessed of the Lord, is a place of rest. It's a place of blessing. It's a refuge from the world. And you see that here in verse 8. You also see it over in chapter 3, verse 1. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek,'" and it's the same word, "rest for you, that it may be well with you." And that's where she plays matchmaker. And she says, "Oh, here's how you need to go get this man." And so she said, "Should I not seek that rest for you?" And so one of the things that we see from this, one of the themes, is the blessing that God intends marriage to be and the home to be. And in the place of her rest, verse 9, is each in the house of her husband. So she's basically wishing for them to be remarried, to be reestablished, and to go into that place. So she kisses them, and then they lifted up their voices and wept. Verse 10, they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." So their initial response is, "Well, let us go with you." And then she responds and basically says, what are you going to do for me? Or what can I do for you ultimately? And she says, verse 11, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Am I pregnant so that I could provide for you husbands? Our relationship, at least initially, was based on the fact that you married my sons. And I'm not pregnant. I can't give you any husbands." Verse 12, "Turn back, my daughters, go, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons," let's say a husband dropped out of the sky and God gave him one right now. "By the time I got pregnant, by the time the babies were born, if I could have those babies, would you wait for them?" is what she asked. "Would you wait the 12, 13 years necessary? And by that time, you're going to be so much older. And I detach yourself from me because I can't help you." And then notice in verse 13, "No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And so even in her grief at the loss of her husband and the loss of her sons, she is grieved because in the Lord, from her perspective at this point, causing the hand of the Lord being against her, that was her perspective. We can ask some questions. Was that the case? But from her perspective, the hand of the Lord was against me, and I'm sad because now you have been affected by it, because I believe that God's hand has been against me. My husband has died. My sons have died. And I'm sorry that you are part of the collateral and part of the fallout of the Lord's hand being against me. How did they respond? Verse 14, they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So Orpah is convinced. She weighs out the options. She says, it is best for me to stay in my land, to get a husband. And let's not be at least too hard on her, because the thought of a Moabite woman going into Israel and finding a husband is pretty absurd. I mean, that's going to be very unlikely for her. So she might be a realist and say, that being the case, you know, if I'm going to have a family and if I'm going to be provided for and not live in utter poverty, maybe I should stay in the land. Okay? But how does Ruth? Ruth clings to her. And she has now a personal attachment to Naomi herself. And she said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. Which I find a very interesting phrase for a Jewish woman. She doesn't just say go back to your own people. She says she's also gone after her own gods. And you should follow after her. It seems initially she's saying not only stay with your people, but stay with your own gods. Now, was this a wise test? Was this something similar to what Joshua said at the end of the book of Joshua? If God is God, then serve Him. If these other gods are gods and they're worthy of your word, then go. But choose this day who you will serve. Was this somewhat of a test on Naomi's part? I don't know, but I find it just a bit interesting how she phrases it. You know, go back, follow after your sister, go back to your people and to your gods. At this point, is Ruth struggling with her faith? The Lord is against me. The Lord's hand's against me. Maybe it's better for you to go serve these other gods than to serve the Lord because of the bitterness that I've tasted. Is she struggling with her own faith and God's provision for her? That could be the case as well. But here, even in that darkness, now remember, the backdrop of Judges, the backdrop of a famine, the loss of her husband, and the loss of her two sons. Can we give Naomi the benefit of the doubt that she's genuinely struggling at this point? Or do we expect her to be a superheroine and say, you know, nevertheless, God is great, and I think she's probably struggling in great despair at this point, but now she's going back to Israel. But in that black backdrop, here is the faith of Ruth. Verse 16, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. So there's personal attachment. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. But it goes beyond personal attachment. And she at this point displays at least a surface knowledge of the people of Israel and of the God of Israel being special. And something that she wants to be attached to. She says, your people shall be my people. So she's saying, Moabites, I'm leaving them behind so that your people might become my people. Which is a bold declaration of faith. Because there's no reason to believe that they're going to accept her as a Moabitess woman. And she says, look, it doesn't matter. I want your people to be my people. And your God, my God. So even in the midst of that setting, she seems to have been introduced to the Jewish religion and to the true God, and at this point is displaying, it seems, more faith than Naomi. Naomi says, look, just go back to your people, go back to your gods. And Ruth says, no, I'm sticking with you. Your people are going to be my people, and I'm coming, and your God is going to be my God.
Mm-hmm. I read this book this week as well, and when I read that part, the first thing that came to my mind was what your type of men must have been.
Amen. And that being the case, you also see God's electing grace. Where did Orpah go? She went back to her people and her gods. So, yeah, that's a good point. But she knows enough of them that she knows also that God in His glory is wrapped up with His people. That they're not two separate things. Yes, Orpah means, let me see, stubbornness. And Ruth means friendship. Yeah, yeah. And so, believing that it is both a true story and a wonderful piece of narrative, and the meaning of names in the Bible, this is one of those things that liberal scholars will say, oh, come on. I mean, you really expect us to believe that people were named that? I mean, it's obviously, you know, the writers wink, wink, you know, this isn't true, this is just a story, you know. And we say, no, it is true. Because she is put in the lineage of Christ himself, putting her in a historical setting. Good question, though. Sickly, pining, Orpah's stubbornness, and Ruth's friendship. Okay, so she expresses this faith. Verse 18, when she saw, that is Naomi, saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. And now the two of them went until they went to Bethlehem. By the way, who remembers what Bethlehem means? And here's a bit of irony in the story as well. What's that? Mm-mm. Bethlehem, house of bread. And why did they leave? Because there was no bread. There was a famine in the land. They went to a Gentile country. They had to leave the house of bread. Now they are going back to the house of bread, where God is going to provide for them. Wonderful storytelling and true storytelling. So when that happened, verse 19, they came to Bethlehem, and it happened when they had come back to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? And so obviously they were seen to be, well, they had the financial ability to leave the land. Poor people don't move very easily. So it may be that this indicates that they were a prominent family within Bethlehem and within Israel. Comes back, it wasn't just like, oh, well, there are those good, there's an excitement about that, and they're stirred up about it. And they ask the question, is this Naomi? Is this pleasant? Is their question. And it makes more sense when you put that in there. Is this pleasant? Her response makes more sense when you understand the meaning of her name. Is this pleasant? Verse 20, but she said to them, do not call me pleasant. Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. And the meaning of the name Mara in Hebrew is bitterness. Don't call me pleasant, call me bitterness. So she has actually changed her name in one sense. Though, interestingly, that name does not stick throughout the rest of the book. So and she says, because not just bitter things have happened, the Almighty. So she's still clinging to the reality of God being the true God, being the Almighty God. But God, in the context of all of this that has happened, I have a bitter life. God has dealt with that. She doesn't say she's bitter, though she may be at this point. But she says, God has dealt bitter, very bitterly with me. Now listen to this phrase, verse 21. I went out full. And so it seems that Naomi has lost a bit of historical perspective after 10 years. You didn't go out. I mean, you did have a husband and sons, but you didn't go out full as far as, you know, you left because there was a desperate famine in the land. But this begins a certain motif and theme here. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. That is, I would suggest, a statement of unbelief. And of a degree of despair. But she doesn't realize that in Ruth, God has brought her back full. And it's like a seed of something that's not yet burst forth. I mean, there is going to be abundant blessing. And you see that at the end of the books. But it's kind of a P.S. Oh, by the way, Naomi is full. And this is how God is going to continue that line. But this is her perspective at the time. The Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me. So again and again, there's this theme that in the midst of her suffering, it is the Lord that has done it. Verse 22. So Naomi returned and Ruth the Moabitess. And that's going to be an interesting phrase. She is referred to several times in the book. Ruth the Moabitess. Ruth the ancestor of an incestuous relationship with Lot. Not Avraham, the father of the faithful. Ruth, the child of an incestuous relationship. I mean, that's stinging every single time it comes. Ruth, the Moabitess. Ruth, the Moabitess is going to come over and over again. Now they came, verse 22. They returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. And so that's an indicator. And even that, it's the beginning of a harvest. In a famine, you don't really have a harvest. And after 10 years, the word that she heard that God had brought, verse 6, visited his people, giving them bread. They come, and this is the earliest harvest of all the harvests that they're going to have. So they come at the beginning, and this is the first kind of glimmer of hope at this point. If you want to think about the momentum of the story, here's good, and the story starts way down here. And then instead of kind of, oh, we're getting better, it goes and plummets far, far down. But now, for the first time, there's some hope that there might be something better in the context of this famine. Verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 1. And then we're really moving into another chapter, another scene of the book. Okay, so that's chapter 1. Dark days become darker. She's sent out. Naomi returns. She thinks she's empty. She is bitter, or the Lord has treated her bitterly. And she returns only with this despised Moabite woman, which, quite frankly, is not going to help her in the context of Bethlehem have much favor with the people, probably, because she has an unclean Gentile living in her house at this point. All right, chapter 2, Ruth meets Boaz. This is what I'm calling God's provision in a field. And God's going to provide for them food. And we're going to start having a reversal of this U-shaped decline in regards to the story. First of all, God begins to provide food for them. Eventually then, and it's kind of a reversal, remember it was the issue of food, the loss of a husband, and the loss of sons. And then as it turns back up, it's the provision of food, the provision of a husband, and then offspring or a son at the beginning of the book. And then that son, that trajectory going up and leading us to David. Okay, so that's something of the flow of the story itself. Well, there was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. Boaz's name means swift strength. Okay, so we learn later, you know, we might think of him as a young, dashing guy that steals her heart away, but we learn later that he is actually an older man, older than certainly not a contemporary by way of age of Ruth, probably younger than Naomi, but he's not considered one of the young men that would ordinarily marry in this kind of a case. Verse 2, so Ruth and Moabite said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I might find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she has picked up enough of the Jewish law that she understands that in the Mosaic law, God had said that when they glean fields, that whatever falls on the ground should be left on the ground for the poor to come and pick up themselves. And that the corners of the fields, they shouldn't try to get every single stalk in the corner of the fields, but you leave the corner of the fields unharvested so the poor can come and get that. And it was a way, now you didn't harvest that and stack it up for the poor just to come and take. They had to come and work for it, which I think is an incredible, a very important principle in regards to issues of welfare and provision of the poor, is that it wasn't a handout. It wasn't, you know, just to put out your arms and I'll give it to you. She's going to have to go and work for this. She's going to have to bend over. She's going to have to stoop over. She's going to have to go and rub that grain out. It wasn't her coming at the end of the day with a big bucket at first, and they just pour it in, and here's all the work done for you. So the welfare system that God provided was a welfare system in which work was integrated with it. That's what one of the things we see here. So she asked the question, let me go. Let me follow Mosaic law. And even in this, there's a bit of faith, maybe at worst case presumption, because that was for the people of Israel. But I take that back. It was for the stranger who is among you as well, for the poor, the stranger who's among you. So she would certainly qualify. So she is taking advantage in a good sense of God's provision for the poor and for the stranger who is in the land. So she does not say, we're introduced, by the way, verse 1, but don't think that she's introduced to Boaz at this point. Verse 1 is just letting us in on what's going to be happening, but she hasn't read the script. She doesn't say, okay, let me go look for Boaz's field. You know, she says, let me go, and whoever I might find favor in their sight, let me go and glean. And then we have Naomi saying, go, my daughter. Verse 3, then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. So the reapers would come through first. She would follow after them. You could always see the difference between those who were harvesting and the poor among them. That way it was a humbling thing because you knew whose field it was and whose field it wasn't, and that they were dependent on the owner of the field. And as she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech, and so that gives us a verbal key that this is not something she intended. I mean, she happened to do this. Now, we know that God is working, and that's one of the things that we're going to come to, is God is providentially working in very ordinary circumstances. She's being very diligent. She is doing what she knows that she needs to do to provide. And God is sovereignly orchestrating and directing even the field that she goes to. Verse 4, now, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered him, the Lord bless you. So I think that is the storyteller telling us a bit of the character of Boaz. As he appears on the field and he's got his workers there, we learn, first of all, he's a worshiper of the true God. He's not one of the apostates that we've seen back in the book of Judges. And that his servants likewise return that blessing, which means he's instilled to them some of that worship. And that we are getting an indicator that this is another bright light in the land of Israel. This is a man that is to be desired by a woman. This is a faithful man that has God's hand of blessing on him. Verse 5, then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And so either because she's beautiful or because she's a stranger, he asked the question, whose young woman is this? Verse 6, so the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, it is a young Moabite woman. There again, the name of the Moabitess is stuck there. The Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. I think, again, the storyteller is telling us something about the character of her. She is the Proverbs 31 woman. She is one who came out early in the morning. She has been working all day, and he just happens to mention she rested a little while in the house. Otherwise, and other than trying to convey some important information, why would you even say that? I mean, people take breaks all the time. I think he's exalting her character. This is a woman that's been out here working very diligently. She isn't one of these poor people that just comes out and expects a handout. She is one who from morning until now, though she rested a little while in the house. Verse 8, then Boaz said to Ruth, I got to meet this girl. So he goes to her. Boaz says to Ruth, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? And she's been called a Moabitess at this point. She's been addressed with terms of affection by Naomi. But here's a total stranger in whose field she has come. And I suggest this is a term of great affection, that he's extending grace to her. He doesn't look at himself as superior to her because she's from another land, because of her family heritage. He comes to her with great grace and says, will you not listen? And then he makes this wonderful provision. Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women. And so he takes great interest in her. We figure out that one of the reasons he takes great interest is because Naomi's within his family. It's his brother's family. His former brother's wife. This is, I think, the uncle. It just says relative. I don't know if it indicates uncle, but somewhere in a close family relationship, though, there is going to be one closer, so I don't know if that would be an uncle, so it may be a cousin. At any rate, what is going on here is there's a provision. He says, look, don't go into any other fields. You hang out and you stay close by my young women. It's almost as if he is employing her for that. Verse 9, let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. So even in that, he's not saying that she has the job of a reaper, but that she can still follow and get the blessing of that without doing the full labor. And he says, have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? Indicating in the days of the judges, young men did things that they should not do, and he had to command them, do not do that. You lay a finger on her, I'm coming after you. Okay, so he is now already spreading his protective wings and care over her. He's providing for her food. And already he's telling the young guys of the land, who are his family within Israel, you touch that Moabitess woman and I'm coming after you. Okay, do not touch her. And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. And there is a bit of provision there. The men are the ones who have to haul out these heavy vessels of water. And you are welcome and blessed with that. Verse 10. So she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" So he understands, she understands he's gone far beyond the grace that was required by law to provide for her. He's gone beyond the call of duty. He's just not a man of the letter of the law. He has a gracious heart toward her. And she doesn't say, "Well, it's about time somebody recognized me around here and gave me what I deserve." She said, "This grace and this favor is unmerited. I don't deserve it. How did this happen?" Verse 11, Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before." And then here is another invocation of blessing. We saw the first one back with Naomi as she was blessing Orpah and Ruth and said, "May the Lord give you rest in the house of your husband." And here we have another invocation of blessing. And this happens several times through the book. "The Lord repay your work and a full reward." Here's the difference between the empty and the reward motif. "A full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." Okay, now that's going to be important because she's later going to come and ask him to take her under his wings of refuge. But right now he says that in the fact that you've attached yourself to Naomi, you've attached yourself to this people, and you've attached yourself to God, you've come under the wings of refuge of the Lord himself. And then she said, "Let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I'm not like one of your maidservants." Okay. Well, our time is getting away from us. There's no way I can cover the rest of the book, but I hope that whets your appetite and builds up some of the tension of the story. We have God's provision in the field. Basically, she goes back to Naomi. Naomi sees that this is the Lord's providential dealing with her. Verse 20, "Blessed be the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." Naomi recognizes and I think this is the first time that she blesses the Lord. Up to this point, there's been bitterness, there's been struggle, there's been darkness. God has dealt with me bitterly. God's hand has been against me. And I think this is the first blessing that Naomi has given, which we should pay attention to. "Blessed be the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." She sees what God is doing in this is not only a blessing to her, but also that God is working in a way to bless her husband, her sons. And when you think about the importance of the continuing of the line and the genealogy of a family in those days, that's probably what she's alluding to, that God is working and is in business here and something's getting ready to happen, that even the dead are going to find the kindness of the Lord and what he's about to do. In some sense, she is almost prophetic in this announcement. So what we have is then through the end of the chapter. So verse 23, "So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest. And she dwelt with her mother-in-law." And so that kind of tells us, and it speeds up the pace of the story a bit. This is basically one day that she meets him. Naomi recognizes the blessing, and then it fast forwards to the end of the harvest and says that's what she did. She stayed close by. Now, what we find in chapter 3 then is what I'm calling the proposal at the threshing floor. So God has provided food. And now at the end of that harvest time, God is going to provide a husband. So what we find then in chapter 3, by way of summary, is Naomi is playing matchmaker. And I wish there was time. There's some very, very intimate moments within this chapter. Basically, what happens is she plans something that probably few of us fathers would plan in the same way. But basically, I want you to go to Boaz when he is celebrating the harvest. And it's very specific. In verse 7, after Boaz had eaten and drunk of the wine and the blessing of the harvest, His heart was cheerful, and he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Probably he stayed with the harvest to keep from thieves, that kind of thing. And she came softly, verse 7, uncovered his feet and lay down. There's some very intimate love story details here. One of them is verse 3, when Naomi says to her, "Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself," which meant a really nice perfume. "Anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor." And she is going to be, and you wonder in the big picture, you know, why doesn't Boaz do this first? And maybe because there was a nearest of kin. But basically, the women are being a bit aggressive in the story. And you can do with that what you want, whether you think that's a good idea or not. But that's what happens. And the Lord blesses it. So Naomi says, "Okay, I want you to get smelling real nice and looking real nice. And I want you to show up when he is asleep and he has eaten well and had a lot of wine. And he is just happy as a whatever. And I want you to go, and there's nothing sexual that takes place, but I want you to go and approach him and express your intentions and your interest in him." So that's what happens. Verse 7, she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now, it happened at midnight. So apparently she's there for a while. Okay, so at midnight, perhaps when the wine had worn off a little bit, that the man was startled. Can you imagine? You're there and fat and happy and well-fed, and so you're startled. "There's somebody at my feet." So what happens? There a woman is lying at his feet. And actually what she does, it causes a bit of a draft on him. She comes and uncovers his feet. And, you know, it's probably startling. "Why are my feet cold?" Something like that. But comes and there's a woman there. Now, it happened at midnight that the man was startled, turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. He can't see who she is. It's too dark. And he said, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." Do with this what you want. But she proposes. It's kind of a reverse proposal here. She is expressing her interest. And I suggest it's probably that because he counted himself out. I'm too old. She's not going to have interest in me. I'm glad to provide her for her, and I care for her, and I love her. But at this point, there's no indication of romantic love. It's this sense of grace and mixed with duty and responsibility. But she comes, and despite his discounting himself, she comes and says, "Take your maidservant," or literally, "spread the corner of your garment over your maidservant." Basically, she has uncovered his feet, and now symbolically, by him taking that and throwing that over her, and it could be translated a couple of different ways, but it has the idea of the same phrase, "The Lord has spread his wings and covered me for refuge." She is basically proposing to him, saying, "I want you to take me, and you be my refuge, and you be my caretaker." The Lord is doing that. And I suggest that it's clear that it's more than a request to continue to take care of her in regards to her physical needs. That's very abundantly provided for. There's no indication. He responds by saying, verse 10, then he said, and here's how we know. Then he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning." And he thinks about her kindness to Naomi and what a blessing. Remember, he commends her for that. He says, "But what you are doing now for me, an older man, is of greater kindness than even what you did for Naomi." He doesn't say, "Well, you know, I'm the man," kind of thing. He's saying, "You approaching me in this way is an act of mercy. You approaching me in this way is itself an act of loving kindness. Blessed are you, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich," which again indicates he would be classified as an older man, or at least not among the young men. And so it wasn't romantic love, first and foremost. The guy caught her eye, and he is the starving poet, and she went after him, you know. And he said, "You had the capacity to marry any of these young men, but you've chosen me." Also, notice in verse 9, when she makes this proposal, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. It is literally, you are the Goel, you are the kinsman redeemer. You are one who by law can take provision. And here's where it gets a bit tricky. Because according to the law, remember, if a man has a wife, and the man dies, by the law, if he has a brother, to continue this man's line, he was responsible to be with the wife and to provide an offspring for this man's inheritance so that he could keep the land. We're seeing that that is more broadly applied at this time in Israel's history because he is Boaz is not, from what we understand, a closest of kin to the man. If he had been, the next chapter in which there this other guy comes up who is a nearer kin, I don't think you can get a nearer kin than the brother. So it may be that this other guy was a brother or a first cousin and that Boaz was a second cousin, but he's more distant here. And so we see that the law is being applied in a broader way, but that's basically what she says, that according to the law, I had a husband, my husband died, and I'm asking you to take me under your wings, and she's appealing to the law for it. And so there's a bit of legal discussion at this point. And because she calls upon that, he recognizes that there's a roadblock. Now notice in verse 11, and then we're going to need to end here. Verse 11, and now my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request. He accepts her proposal. Make of that what you will, that's what he does. For all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. She has such a reputation. He said, I don't hesitate to accept and to take you to myself because everybody knows you're a virtuous woman. Then comes the, not so much the antagonist, but the rival. That's where the issue comes up. There's someone closer than me in way of the law and relatives. Basically, I got to get this guy out of the way first. You know, he's not going to kill him or anything. I mean, the story could go really bad at this point. But he basically says, I got to deal with this. And let me jump ahead to chapter 4, show you some of the genius of how he deals with this character. It's a great, great way of telling it. So he sends her off quietly and says, okay, and he dumps this big, huge store of grain, and she comes back to Naomi, and Naomi says, ah, things went well, didn't they? She's like, yeah, you betcha. Chapter 4, now Boaz went up to the gate, and this is, it's now moving from Moab to the return, the field, and really you have, you could almost do this in a play and have four backdrops. You have first the land of Moab. The second backdrop would be the field, Boaz's field. The third backdrop would be the threshing floor. And then the fourth backdrop for chapter 4 would be the gate of the city. Okay, so he goes into the city. He makes sure that this is a public event. He pulls these elders of the city in so that they'll be witnesses. And when the deal's done, he takes off his sandal and hands it to him. And some of those interesting traditions. But here's basically what he does. He says, sit down. Verse 3, then he said to the close relative, Naomi, to this close relative, he gets this man as he's coming by the gate and he's got all of this set up. He says to this man, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. Let me just say that in the Hebrew, that can carry a tense of it's is going to sell, because later in the chapter, he purchased it from her, which means that she hadn't already sold it. So the New King James Version is not the best translation here, but literally it could be translated, is going to sell a piece of the land because of the poverty and because of needing to sell off her husband and her son's inheritance. That's getting ready to be sold outside the family, and he's coming along and saying, here's an opportunity for you to keep it in the family because he's a near relative. So verse 4, and I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And he said, his first response is, yeah, I'll take it. Now, he's left a lot of details out at this point, but listen, this is genius. You want this piece of land? You redeem it? You know, buy it from a poor woman? Probably get a good price. He says, yeah, I'll do that. Verse 5, then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from the Ruth the Moabitess. So you're not just going to pay a poor woman, but you're also going to pay Ruth for that. And you're going to pay Ruth. And here's the first time her name comes up again, the Moabitess. The incestuous offspring of those cursed and wretched people. You know, the guy's going, oh. Mm. He's already said she's a virtuous woman. So in one sense, this is kind of an insult, but he doesn't mean it toward her. But I think he's bargaining here in a very wise way. The Moabitess, the wife of the dead. And I'll say it delicately, it means she's been married. She's been with another man. So this guy, you want this? Yeah. Well, not only are you going to do that, you're going to get the Moabitess who's the wife of the dead. Whew. Oh, no. Isn't that great? And you know what's going to happen? Because you're the nearest of kin, the baby that's born of you first, it's not even really going to be considered yours. It's going to be the inheritance of her first husband. So he's the guy that wants, he's telling the other customer about all the bad points of the car that he wants to buy. You know, he's like, well, look at that. I mean, those tires, you know, they're used. And I bet it doesn't really, listen to that rattling in there. It's like, he says, to perpetuate the name of the dead through this inheritance. And the close relative said, oh, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. Isn't that great? That is great storytelling. The guy first says, yeah, I'll redeem it. Well, by the way, oh, never mind. But he's glad to do that. Because he cares for her and he's committed to her. Basically, you are witnesses this day. They seal the deal in a public setting. And he takes off his sandal and says, here you go, the deal's done. Okay, and that's one of the commentators said that he was forsaking his right to place his sandals on that land as his own. That might be the case. I thought it might be something as simple as, you know, you can talk me into something, but when I take off my shoe and hand it to you, it's pretty clear that I'm making a deal. Nobody can come away and say, well, we're uncertain whether he said yes or no. Verse 10, moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren, from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. And now notice this amazing, this is another one of those may the Lord blessings, this invocation. Verse 11, and all the people who were at the gate, and the elder said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house. Now remember, Moabitess woman, Lot, Chemosh, foreigner, idol worshippers, despised, stranger in the land. Listen how she had won their heart by her virtuous acts toward Naomi and now toward Boaz. May the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. It is giving the greatest feminine blessing to a Moabitess. And may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your name be well known for many years. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Another sordid story, but still a story of blessing. Because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he went into her, the Lord gave conception, and she bore a son. There's another motif. God gives the grain. God gives the child. He's the one that fills. Verse 14, then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. You would expect for them to say, blessed be Ruth. But in the big picture, this isn't even about Ruth and Boaz. This is about Naomi. This is about the tribe to which Naomi belonged to, because this was about the people of God, Israel, ultimately because it was about God. So Naomi is then considered, this baby is considered, because it couldn't go to the brother, which would then go to the parents, and it couldn't go to the parent of the father, So basically, she's considered the child of Naomi and the offspring of Naomi. She's actually kind of the grandmother. But it's considered her child to continue the line of her family of this particular group. Verse 17, also the neighbor women gave him a name saying, there's a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. Now, I didn't look up that name. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. And there's the bridge from the dark days of the judges over into 1 and 2 Samuel that's coming. This is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. And Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon. And Nahshon begot Salmon. Does anybody know who Salmon married? Who? Rahab the harlot. The prostitute. And the offspring of Rahab, a Gentile prostitute, and Salmon, was Boaz. This man in the story. This is a quite surprising turn. Because God says, you are my people, I will work through you, I will work through you. And here is a glaring testimony of God using some very unexpected people, including Rahab, a Gentile from Jericho. And Salmon and Rahab begot Boaz, who becomes the husband in the story of Ruth. Boaz begot Obed, Obed begot Jesse, Jesse begot David. God brings in these two Gentile women, and three of the four women mentioned in the genealogy of Christ are Gentiles. The other one, I believe, is Tamar, who again has a very... The four women in the genealogy of Christ demonstrates the majesty, the grace, the mercy, the amazing ways that God works out of the way that we might write the story. We put all the good, strong, virtuous people that have no baggage that they're bringing with them. But that's redemption, verse 4, unit 4, redemption and marital blessing. Four quick applications or themes. I've already mentioned these all, I think. First of all, the providential care of God. Though in the beginning, God kind of gets a lot of mud slung at him regarding the hard stuff, in the end, it is the Lord who is invoked. It is the Lord who is worshipped. It is the Lord who is honored. Ultimately, it is the Lord who is glorified through David and David's greater son, Jesus Christ. This is another chapter of the master story that God is writing to bring about His own glory. In God's providential care, in contrast, there's nothing clearly miraculous in this book. I mean, you look at Samson and perhaps Jael and some of the other things that happen in the book of Judges. I mean, there's some pretty miraculous stuff that's going on. You read the book of Ruth for what it is. God's working, but He's working behind the scenes. And what kind of a field a girl goes to? The fact that it was the Lord who brought the famine on the land and lifted the famine. And you know what that was all about? It was picking up Ruth. You know, you think, well, just send her an invitation and tell her to come on over and make this a lot easier. But it was about, in the backdrop of that, picking up Ruth and taking back and doing that in a very unexpected way. The providential care of God in blessing and even during the difficult things. Number two, an expression of godly womanhood. And let me say here, I'm not calling it the expression of godly womanhood. It is an expression. The customs were different. There are things in the book I don't think should be taken. Okay, what this says is that women should always propose to men. You know, no, what it says is that she did propose to him and he accepted that proposal in those unusual circumstances. But the issue at heart is that all know that you are a virtuous woman, and her virtuosity, her virtuousness was demonstrated in her kindness, her commitment to the Lord, even when she was a stranger in the land. So it's an expression of godly womanhood. Number three, God's mercy and salvation to the Gentiles. I've already mentioned that in regard to Rahab and regards to Ruth. Then fourth, and this is worthy to dig into a bit more, but the idea and the theme of the kinsman redeemer that most commentators say is an analogy. It is an expression of Jesus, who is the kinsman redeemer. And so when we ask the question of how is Christ seen in the book of Ruth, it may be that one of the greatest places he's seen is how Boaz is the kinsman redeemer who forfeits his own rights and humbles himself for the glory of another, and how Christ himself humbled himself and did not raise his own voice in the street for the glory of God and for the good of his people. And so probably that theme is in there as the kinsman redeemer as well. All right, well, let's pray, and we'll begin our worship at quarter after, since we got started a little bit late. Father, we pray as we read the book of Ruth the next time that we go through that you would help us to read it with fresh eyes and fresh imaginations, and recognize that you are the God who delights in some of these details and the telling of a story, how the book of the Bible has not been handed to us as a systematic theology saying, this is what you are, this is what you do, but rather that you display yourself through narrative and through history and through human story and the working of your providence within a people. We ask that you would help us to read it as you have created it for our imaginations to be stirred, our emotions to be moved, that you would help us to do that with freshness. Lord, move our hearts, move our emotions, move our wills and our intellects in the coming hours we gather to worship you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.